Welcome to MacGuffin Man. I'm Alex, and with me, as usual, is James. If you want to listen to our previous podcasts, we most recently talked about Take Shelter and Midnight Special in one episode, as well as the film Moonlight before that, Manchester by the Sea, and Jackie. You can go to themacguffinmen.com. You can follow us on Twitter at themacguffinmen for sporadic tweets about new podcasts. And that's about it. Let's get to the theme song.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. And now, here are Alex and James.
All right. That classic old-timey crank piano has finished playing our theme song. And what are we talking about here today, James?
We are talking about The General.
Yes.
The 1926 Buster Keaton film.
Yes. I'm glad you explained the latter, because when I've told people that I was watching The General, they were like, what is that? Like, nobody knows who this is. The millennials are not aware of Buster Keaton's greatest success, or greatest failure turned success, I suppose.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
Yeah.
I mean,
I have some friends that are really big on Chaplin. I feel like that, well, we can count that as a win. But
well, yeah, I mean, if you want to start with that, you remember in Chuck Klosterman's most recent book, when he says that most art forms and genres end up being summed up in one person.
Yes.
Yeah, I think silent film is just, it's kind of locked up for Chaplin.
Oh, for sure.
it's a done deal. Yeah. And during their lifetimes, it was, or immediately after their careers, it was kind of widely understood that Charlie Chaplin, Harold Lloyd, and Buster Keaton were the three geniuses of silent film comedy.
Mm-hmm.
And Buster Keaton and Harold Lloyd seem to have kind of fallen by the wayside as far as popular culture. Do you think that's correct assessment?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah. Stephen Benedict might disagree, but like, for people that are out in the real world, yes, 100%.
Do you know why that might be?
Why people chose Chaplin over the other two?
Yeah, I mean, Harold Lloyd's movies were probably making the most money and being the most successful while they were actually making them. And he seems to be the one that, I mean, maybe he and Buster Keaton are kind of interchangeable for two or three, but I agree. I mean, I think it's Chaplin in number one by a long shot.
Yeah, for sure. And I would say Buster Keaton is too. But that might just be a Jackie Chan bias, but because he's Jackie Chan mentions Buster Keaton all the time. But I forget what the question was, because now I'm thinking about Jackie Chan.
why Chaplin?
Why Chaplin?
When it really wasn't that way at the time.
Yeah, well, I think, I mean, you mentioned the Klosterman book that I love very much. The most popular thing is rarely the thing that endures over time. So it's like, when people are looking back at 2017 in film, the biggest successes were the Marvel movies, but that's not what's going to last, right? And I think, like, that is an assessment that most people will agree with. Nobody's going to watch Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2 for historical purposes in 50 years, you know? Nobody's going to be interested in that, or for anything outside of historical purposes. I think it's just... you know, what people gravitate to at the time of something's release is not always the same as what people gravitate to over time. Once you get removed from the constructions of the world that a new movie is released into, right? Like, a movie's success is so dependent on, and I'm speaking mostly about a modern movie because I know more about the modern film landscape than I do about 1926, but some of the similarities remain. Your gross depends very frequently more often on your advertising campaign than anything else. And with time, the advertising campaign stops about 2 weeks after the movie's released. And with time, the only thing that continues to exist is word of mouth, right? Like, so sometimes you'll get a success that is built around like a good movie with a good ad campaign that continues to be a success through word of mouth. Get Out is a really good recent example of that. But the vast majority of huge financial successes are huge financial successes because they quote unquote bought the first weekend or first month of box office with advertising. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I would imagine that whatever the the 1926 equivalent of covering subway walls with Guardians of the Galaxy posters for the general happen for the general, you know, just because this is such an expensive movie.
Yeah. And Buster Keaton is arguably as cute as Baby Groot. I think history has made up their mind about that fact. So.
Sure. My eyes have made up. Although, I hate Baby Groot, so it's not like I'm defending Baby Groot here. But my eyes have made up how they feel about Buster Keaton.
Yeah.
And cute is not the word I would use.
Yeah, I think there's a few reasons, but I think the reason Chaplin ended up staying kind of at the top of the pile as time passed is a few things. I mean, I think he's got the most iconic look.
Oh, absolutely. Unquestionably.
Yeah, like Harold Lloyd had his hat and his glasses and stuff, but Chaplin, I mean, head to toe, with the exception of certain movies, always looked the same. Or, I mean, his tramp outfit changes slightly, but it's very, very similar. Mm-hmm. And Buster Keaton didn't quite have that. And Chaplin, I think, is the most interesting figure of all of them. Mm-hmm. I think Harold Lloyd's life and Buster Keaton's life are very interesting, and I'm sure we'll touch on some of the interesting things about Keaton. But Chaplin, you know, dabbling in politics with the Great Dictator and just some of the things, like some things like that, make his story, I think, the most interesting one, even if, you know, some of his gags or stunts might not be as good. I still think it's to sum everything up about a movie star in one character, I think Chaplin definitely takes it as well.
And he just sort of, he has part of the difference, I think. I feel like Charlie Chaplin has more natural charisma than Buster Keaton does. I haven't watched a lot of Harold Lloyd. And when I say I haven't watched a lot of, I haven't watched any Harold Lloyd films. But so I can't really speak to that. But the difference I found between Buster Keaton and Charlie Chaplin, for the most part, is that Charlie Chaplin reminded me of like a really graceful dancer in movies where I watch him perform, whereas Buster Keaton reminds me of a stuntman. And there's just more there's more grace to Chaplin, and what Buster Keaton is doing is still very impressive, but just you know, on like a silent screen test, Charlie Chaplin is just a more watchable performer to me, you know. There's just a certain charisma he has that that I don't think Buster Keaton had. Yeah,
and I think you're right in saying Chaplin's more graceful, but I, you know, to talk about all three of them, I think for the silent comedy era, I think the iconic stunt or the iconic image of a gag, I think, might be Harold Lloyd hanging off the clock in Safety Last. Mm-hmm. I think the most impressive stunt, or the most ambitious one, is the train crash in The General, and I can't really think of what it is for Chaplin, but I still think undeniably as a figure he's the most iconic.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, I didn't know this train crash existed until I watched the movie. I didn't know before the train crash happened that happened. When it happened, okay, I said, holy shit, out loud. I would agree with you about the Harold Lloyd hanging off the clock. Who was it that the house falls over and the person, the performer, is in the place where the window is? You know, that's Buster Keaton.
Actually, yeah.
That would be my if not number one, that would be my argument for 1A. You know, that seems really famous to me.
Yeah,
as a singular moment. But
yeah, and I think of all the ones we've discussed, the most impressive in how dangerous it is.
Oh yeah.
Like him, Harold Lloyd hanging off the clock. I mean, that was some trick photography to make that look a lot more dangerous as it is. It's still a very impressive kind of acrobatic feat, but and I mean, not to take anything away from this train crash, but there wasn't people on the train to be hurt.
Yeah. Too bad nobody told the people watching the crash that until after the crash.
Yeah, okay. So let's get to The General.
Yeah.
As we said, a 1926 movie. I like to describe it as that generation's Mad Max Fury Road.
I mean, I don't think you're wrong. Yeah,
I've got a few reasons for it too. Yeah. It's kind of.
I mean,
I
haven't seen Stagecoach. That was the movie that George Miller would explicitly reference at the time. But anyway, sorry.
Oh, okay.
I didn't mean to derail what you were saying. No pun intended. Continue.
Well, why did you think that that connection makes sense?
Oh, it's just. This movie, you get a little bit of setup, and then the action starts and then the movie ends. You know, like it's a very, very concise action oriented picture.
Yeah, and it's a very linear chase. I mean, they go one way, they turn around, and they come back, which is very Fury Road. Mm-hmm. Some things that you would assume are fake, like that train crash, are exactly what took place for filming.
Yep.
And
there was that guy at the front of the train that was just shredding on an electric guitar, the general. So.
Yeah, that's right. And no, I think our protagonists have almost an equal amount of dialogue in both movies.
Yeah, I mean, if we're talking words, then yes. If we're accounting for Tom Hardy's infinite number of hems and haws, then Tom Hardy wins. But yes,
yeah. So I mean, it's, as you said, I mean, it's a very concise movie. It's a train heading in one way and a train heading in another way, and a narrative structured around it. And we talk a lot about when we find action is well done. One of the reasons is that the area that you are about to witness all this action has some time to set up the geography. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you get a sense of the geography of the landscape in this movie, which I think actually adds a lot too. But the train is just, you know, explored in so many ways that seeing things play out over it, I think, works out so well.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And also, you kind of know the geography just in... You understand how train rails work, so you know that there are the limits are known to everybody because everybody knows how a train moves and it's forward.
Yes, and then backward.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I mean, so much of it is just kind of on that one car, and then, you know, we have the moments of Buster Keaton. Oh, sorry, Johnny Gray, I suppose. You know, it is, as we said, it's very linear. It's going in a straight line, but then we get kind of the angle of where he's looking coming into play and action happening behind him that he's missing and very important things. And just very important reaction shots when a train that was immediately in front of him is now gone, or, you know, something behind him sneaks up on him. And as you said, I mean, Chaplin has that charisma and Buster Keaton just plays everything flat. Does that work for you? Do those reaction shots lack because there isn't kind of a more dramatic reaction, or do you think that works?
I mean, it didn't hurt the movie for me, you know, like, but also I can't say I was thinking about them too much. Like, it was just, it just felt like something that kind of needed to be there just to sort of, because, you know, like the sort of Spielberg gaze where you sort of have to show somebody looking at the cool thing or the thing that is in the distance or the thing that just happened behind you to sort of register that, oh, yes, this is a human that is in the middle of the situation. So I guess I didn't think about it. I just sort of accepted it as part of the construction of that type of movie. You know?
His lack of reaction, you mean?
Yeah, yeah, I think so. In that he's just kind of... Johnny Gray is the type of person that is just moving forward and kind of unfazed about these things, sort of thing, you know?
Yeah.
Make sense? I don't know.
No, I think that makes sense. Yeah. That's, you know, beyond Johnny Gray, that's a very Buster Keaton thing. You know, his nickname was the Great Stone Face.
That's what his face looks like.
yep. Yeah, I mean, he grew up in a vaudeville family and... you know, just to mimic the people around him, and especially when he was older, what he saw in silent film, initially tried, you know, something like a Chaplin, you know, the big sort of reactions, the big expressive faces and, you know, gesticulating body movements and stuff like that, but then ended up finding that he would get a bigger laugh just playing it straight. Mm-hmm. And having no reaction, or, you know, his reaction is a slightly longer blink in some of these reaction shots. And I think it's funny. And I think it's a way that he did distinguish himself from other actors that I thought was successful.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, none of those reaction shots made me laugh. I will say that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's interesting that those are his personal reactions. You know, he wrote this movie and directed it, or I co-directed it, I suppose.
Yeah. With Clyde Bruckman.
Yeah. But after the big train stunt that we were discussing when it goes off the bridge, we get that shot of the general, of a not the general, but just another a general who does the same very understated reaction. And it's, you know, you can tell that that's the way Keaton liked to do things. You know, even when it's not his character, it's still a very, very understated reaction for something so incredible happening right in front of you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes. And one more, just, you know, not even on a big stunt, but one kind of non-reaction that I enjoy quite a bit is when he's trying to get time alone with Annabelle near the beginning of the movie and the kids are following them into the house.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and he puts on his hat to go leave and then just turns back around.
Yeah, I like that so much.
Yep. Yeah, no, I enjoy that as well.
So how did you like this movie overall, or is it, did you like it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I enjoyed it. The copy I had potentially the most abrasive soundtrack I've ever heard in my life. It was just the most annoying loop just over and over again. So the second time I watched it, I just put on other music just because I couldn't deal with it. But other than that, like, I enjoyed it. You know, it's a really crisp, fast narrative. You know, it's, what, like 75 minutes long? So, yeah, it's pretty hard not to like it. It's just very, it's a very simple movie that's built around tons of impressive stunts, which I'm on record as I'm consistently impressed by people that are willing to almost kill themselves to entertain me. Like literally, because some of these things are so goddamn dangerous. So yeah, I mean, it was a movie I was probably always going to like. And also, I am pretty fascinated by, people using their past success to sort of make the most ambitious movie that they will ever make in their career. And this seems to very much fit into that for Buster Keaton. So I enjoy that as well.
Yeah. With obviously not the result he was hoping for.
Yeah, you know, exactly. Like, you know, the impressive thing about the actual film is watching Buster Keaton sort of risk his life in these stunts. And then, but the other like secondary thing that's always running underneath that is that he's also risking his career because this is his big swing for the fences, you know, of a passion project that he is now successful enough to get a studio head to pay him to do.
Yeah, very, yes, in a meta way, just very much pushing all your chips into the center of the table. Yeah. And there's no more clear physical metaphor than all these stunts that just literally risk your life just to make the movie a little bit better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. And yeah, and I will say there's a lot of little stuff throughout the movie that, you know, like, I don't think the movie would be hurt if these stunts don't exist, but just things that seem simple that when you watch them on the film that you know are difficult. Like, one that's jumping to mind is when Johnny's on the front of the train and he has one piece of wood and then throws it at another piece of wood to knock the second one off the tracks. Like, that's just in the grand scheme of this movie, it's a very simple stunt, but it's so impressive, you know.
Yeah.
And the even just the way that the wood moves, like the connection he gets on it is so so smooth, and I don't know, just that shot really impressed me, you know.
Oh no, I have notes about that exact same thing, because like, it's just the idea of sitting on like the cow catcher that the front of the train like that, just to sit there, I mean, there's so many small things that could go wrong that end up mangling you or killing you so quickly. So, I mean, that's impressive. But, yeah, that having those railroad ties kind of just on the track, and I know the exact throw you're talking about. When I see him pick it up, I think he's going to throw it so it lands on that other tie in a horizontal way, because that would be the easiest way to make that throw.
Yeah,
like to land it with the widest part landing on it, but he does it like with just the tip of one railroad tie landing on the thinnest part of it to knock it off.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's it's such an impressive throw. And you know, we talked about maybe him not having the grace and some of the acrobatic skills of Chaplin, but yeah, these small, really impressive physical feats that are just dotted all over this movie that, yeah, really don't, might not mean so much on their own, but just to have all these tiny things placed all over it, it all adds up to something so great.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
And not something that's, you know, by any means dangerous, but another physical thing that I find impressive was just more of the vision, like just to see these things. Buster Keaton talked a lot about how he would improvise so many things. You know, they would have an idea of, you know, this is going to be the set of this scene. This is where it's going to take place. This is what has to be achieved by the end of it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's kind of the way they talk about doing Curb Your Enthusiasm scenes. Like, there's like a few things that need to be accomplished by the end of this, but I'm going to do whatever I can to draw laughs in the interim.
Yeah.
And obviously a much different style than Larry David or anybody involved.
Yeah, J.B. Smooth. J.B. Smooth does not appear in The General. Sorry.
No, it's true. Unfortunately, that is a true fact.
Yeah, no, I would have loved to see J.B. Smooth try and operate in the silent era. You know?
Yeah, but it's just kind of the way he looks at things. And in particular in this movie, it's when they go to sign up to enlist and he just stands up on top of the tables in order to walk across all of them to get to the front of the line. I mean, that's just, you know, as I said, kind of a vision thing, just to look at the physical world and see it in a much different way than anybody else, instead of seeing this, you know, obviously designed pathway for you to get to the front of the line. He just thinks about it laterally, or thinks about it vertically, and kind of overcomes these physical obstacles in a way that just aren't apparent to everybody. And to think that he's improvising so many of those things, it's a different type of physical feat than, you know, what we're talking about with throwing the railroad ties, but it's just a certain way of looking at the world. And you know, these movies would employ gag writers and things like that to come up with ideas like that, but it takes kind of the vision of an individual to keep coming up with those, or to know which one of those is good, that I think Buster Keaton in particular is very good at. And I haven't said anything about how much I like Charlie Chaplin in this one, but I do think that Buster Keaton offers some things that Chaplin didn't do as well or as popularly.
Oh, I mean, I would certainly agree with that statement. I can totally understand why Charlie Chaplin's the one that won. And if picking a favorite of the output that I've seen, Charlie Chaplin wins for me. But yeah, Buster Keaton absolutely provides something that Charlie Chaplin doesn't. Going back to the dancer versus a stuntman sort of situation. I don't know. It's very rare watching a Chaplin movie where I'm concerned for his safety, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, and
whereas in The General that happened constantly.
Yeah, and you can see
and this man clearly didn't die making this film, died long after, you know, and so I don't have to worry about his safety anymore. But I don't know, it's still at least a little bit palpable watching the film.
Yeah, and you know, you mentioned Jackie Chan. I mean, you can see the straight line between showing up somewhere or having these objects in front of you or having a geographical location and saying, you know, what can we do with this? How can we use these things in a way that we've never seen anybody else use them, but to make it very entertaining?
Yeah, exactly. Jackie, here's a wall. How do you climb this in the most entertaining way possible?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. Do you have an idea of why, and I'm not saying this because I know the answer, but do you know why this wasn't received that well and ended up becoming something that was received that well? Because, you know, we touched on it a little bit. This was a movie that he really kind of went all out on, and he had gained some, you know, some capital by being a success for so long, and put, you know, well, the studio put $750,000 into making this movie, and it was just kind of had a very lukewarm to negative reception. I didn't know what you thought about the time that had passed that made people maybe change their mind about it.
I don't know about the time passing. I have a very cold take, I suppose, on the why it wasn't received well at the time, because the movie ran pretty over budget, right? Like, the budget was originally something around $400,000, and I think the figure you mentioned is where it topped out. Just because they were doing such difficult things, operating on trains, and you know, you've got to, since they're people's lives are at risk in so many of these scenes, you've got to do rehearsals, and all of these rehearsals are very expensive because it's time, and then actually shooting it is also expensive. So my feeling on movies that run over budget and are already high profile movies before they start producing them, the press seems to always pick on those movies a little bit more. So when you're talking about the reception of The General, you know, whatever equivalent of the trade papers that existed in 1926 would be reporting on this movie, right? Because this would be one of Hollywood's most famous upcoming films, you know? So even if it's only a very small amount of people that actually get this information, if it's just people in Hollywood, that information still includes people that will end up reviewing the movie, right? And so yeah. People, by the time the movie actually comes out, have their knives at it and are ready to sort of attack the movie, because it gets to a point where it's more fun to make fun of than it is to actually watch and enjoy it as a good movie. Now, I'm not saying that's the case all the time. Like, I think the most famous example of this is Heaven's Gate from 1980, the Michael Cimino film. You know, there was a book written on the production of that movie by Stephen Bach called The Final Cut. And I was just reading that probably 6 months ago, and I watched Heaven's Gate. And, you know, watching Heaven's Gate, it's not a great movie, but it's not a bad movie by any means. But when it came out, it was received as like one of the worst movies ever. It was just more fun to pick on than it was to actually watch and absorb. And that's the type of thing that I feel like happened with The General. And you still see this from time to time. I'm trying to think of an example. I mean, this is a shitty example because I don't think Time is going to reconsider the Josh Trank Fantastic Four movie. But the last iteration of the Fantastic Four, like, I never saw that movie, but I read so much about the making of that movie, right? And by the time it was finished, even if it had been a good movie, I think it would have been pretty much dead on arrival, you know? Just because you can reach a certain level of, I don't know, saturation as a piece of garbage that when the thing actually comes out, it doesn't matter what it actually is because people have already decided it's a bag of garbage.
Yeah, like if you'd seen it in a vacuum, this isn't exactly how you'd feel about it, but when you have all this time to kind of prepare yourself for the most negative experience possible, then it just kind of becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Exactly. It's the inverse of the La La Land effect, basically.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I was thinking along those lines, like we talked about this train stunt that's so expensive. And you know, visually, you know, as you said, to watch it now, it's very, maybe not impressive, but, you know, spectacular. And yeah, if you had that time to kind of think of bad things about it and were kind of preparing yourself for something negative, something like that can look bloated and gimmicky instead of, you know, just spectacular and impressive.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, it's like, oh, they just threw a bunch of money at it and made the most simplistic thing. And it's like having a huge explosion at the end of the movie. In modern times, it's not impressive that you were able to throw a bunch of money and time at something. You know, you want something that's done well and done with meaning, and I think that is done well in this movie. Yeah. But I think what you say is right, that the expectations from the right people, you know, the critics and the people who are going to be writing about this in a time when critics and trade papers would have had much more importance than they do now, really sets the stage for that.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah. I don't know why Time would sort of with Time people would reconsider this movie. Typically, some sort of level of critical reconsideration happens with a movie. So because especially a movie from the 20s, what would have to happen, because this is long before the advent of home video and even before television, so you know you're not getting Saturday Night at the Movies or whatever on one of the three major networks, there would have to be some sort of somebody that wants this movie to sort of have a repertory run, right? Like there would have to be some sort of critical groundswell for this movie to get it back in theaters, maybe with Buster Keaton's death, I don't know, just to sort of have it reconsidered. So I don't know how that happened with this movie, but those are ways that those are typically the ways these things happen, you know. Critics start to realize for whatever reason they get interested in Buster Keaton again or this movie for whatever reason, and they watch it again, find a way to watch it again, and then they're just like, oh, I was wrong, this happens sometimes. Maybe I didn't have my coffee before I watched that movie that day, you know, like the human brain is weird and finicky. So that type of thing I think can happen. Yeah
that makes sense. I think in this case it was simply the the advent of television, and Buster Keaton, as a result of this movie and a lot of subsequent things, including some pricey divorces and seemingly decades of alcoholism, Buster Keaton really didn't have a lot of money. Yeah. And he ended up doing a lot of television when television, you know, became an option. And it's important to point out that at this time, a movie star going to television is seen as a very huge step down and very a very desperate sign for a need for money. But I think it was just this movie being played more and more on television. Yeah. Really just sparked a revitalization in the interest in it, and all those things about it, you know, going over budget and being past schedule really, you know, kind of fade into the distance, and you can see something for what it is and base it more on its merits than the articles of a few people in a trade magazine.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and I mean, that's another huge part of this this movie is that, you know, not just the production but the result. I mean, it was, as we said, financially a big failure, critically not received well at the time. It took decades for critical opinion to really come around, and it was the financial result of this film that caused Buster Keaton to sign into a pretty restrictive MGM deal. Mm-hmm. He needed some money, so he ceded a lot of creative control, and as we said, you know, he co-directed this movie, he wrote this movie, he chose this book, The Great Locomotive Chase, out of, you know, any project that he wanted to do, he chose this one. And so he ceded a lot of creative control just as a guaranteed way to receive money, you know, instead of doing what you want and getting a percentage of the profits, he just kind of took a paycheck up front. And there's, you know, just several decades of seemingly lost opportunities for Buster Keaton to make movies that were as good as he was really capable of.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, and something I love so much about these movies that ties into that is it's definitely present in this movie, but it's part of tons of silent comedies, is just the resilience of the main characters. You know, him trying to enlist, for an example, you know, he tries six different ways, you know, to steal someone's piece of paper, to pretend he's someone else, to lie about what he does and who he is. There's that, no matter how harebrained the scheme is, you know, you just try something over and over and come up with something new, and that doesn't work. And I think that's kind of part of the tragedy of his career, is that as a character, as an actor, he was willing to try so much, do so many things, and then to be kind of cornered into this deal at MGM where he just kind of had to do what he was told, that just adds such a wrinkle of tragedy to an already really sad story.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, that type of thing happens with more actors than it doesn't, even famous ones, where you sort of get pigeonholed as one sort of thing, and you might want to do more things. Even, you know, I know Ryan Gosling or whatever doesn't want to do all these stunts, but he might still want to try some things that the world or Hollywood hasn't let him at some point. But yeah, you are right that the Buster Keaton example is a more extreme example of something that happens to actors pretty consistently.
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
Yeah. But yeah, you did mention something that I found interesting about the movie, how he, Buster Keaton's willing to continue to try everything and just keep going. And Johnny Gray specifically, in the movie, is willing to do that. I mean, he's sort of like the train equivalent of a person, in that he's just sort of like, he's got the goal that he's going towards, and he's going on a straight line towards it, as we've talked about. And one of the ways that I found it interesting how the movie sort of depicted Johnny was how there's a real interesting usage of both big and small in this movie, like as a contrast. Buster Keaton doesn't, I don't know how tall Buster Keaton was, does not look like a tall man. And if he was average height, I would be surprised. But we've got this small, physically small person that looks small in frame doing these amazing things. He is trying to join a bigger collective, like the army, you know, like he's trying to join, you know, this large institution. And
yeah. And even Annabelle's brother and father and the people in line are all, you know, much more physically imposing than Johnny Gray is.
Absolutely. And that scene is where I started to piece this together, because even when he is, you know, he's sort of comparing himself, doing, you know, very, very slight gags to compare himself to the stature of these other men. But even behind him, on the wall, there are these giant jars of things and like barrels, and it looks like they even dwarf him. Like, I'm serious. Some of these jars are like taller than his head, you know, and he had a very long face. So like, I don't know. And you just watch all throughout the movie that there's just consistently, I mean, he's on a giant train for the whole movie, so he just consistently looks small. But, you know, there are just little small examples that play out throughout. Like, I forget what precedes the moment of him running after the runaway train, like, and a group is running initially, and then he ends up being the only person running. Do you remember this shot that I'm talking about?
Yeah, it's when the spies have separated the engine from all the other flat cars.
Yeah,
and it takes off, and it's just the other soldiers don't think that they could ever catch up, and he just, you know, as an unstoppable force, just refuses to give up.
Yeah, exactly. But like in that shot specifically, like it's a center framing of the track, and as the train drives away from the camera, and those other people that Buster Keaton ends up running away from, they stay where they are, and they're a big group that Buster Keaton is running away from to accomplish his goal, and he is getting even smaller in the frame and smaller in the frame, as these larger people remain large and continue being more and more imposing, because they are what represents big in the shot, where Buster Keaton is small and will continue to get smaller, and it's only at the end of the movie when both big and small come together as he is able to salute everybody that walks by him, you know, as they have accepted him.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, I think it's just that I guess ambition is the word. I mean, for him to be that small and all these things and still fight on. And, I mean, just even him trying to enlist, you know, he gets rejected because he is valuable. You know what I mean? He's too valuable at home to be sent off to go fight in this war.
Yeah.
That's just never communicated to him. And, you know, then he just persists and he does what he can, and there's kind of these failures of the institutions to fully communicate what his problem is, but his solution is just to keep going and to keep trying.
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah. Anything else about Jenna or Buster Keaton?
I don't know. Like, I mean, I got to talk about the filmmaking, I guess, because I watched this movie two times. There are parts of the movie I don't understand what they did to shoot some shots. Like, the, you know, you'll get a sort of like a medium shot of the train as the train is moving. So you can see that the train is moving, and you've got, say, the front couple cars or whatever, and Buster Keaton in the shot, and the camera is moving along. Like, did they build a separate rail track to sort of have a camera train to run on? Because it just seems like so grand. And and when they have a camera seemingly attached to the front of a train where Buster Keaton is conducting this train, and he's like hanging out the window of the train, and it's just like, by comparison to a lot of the shots in this movie, seems really simple, but at the time must have been so difficult. And those are the type of little things in this movie that I found really impressive. It's just like, how did they get the camera where they got the camera? And at the time, you know, cameras are much more finicky than they are now. It's not like, you know, Michael Bay's making the new Transformers movie where his car's going to flip, and it's like, let's just throw four GoPros on four different corners of this car and just see what happens. You know, like, you have to be really precise with this stuff at the time. And I just thought, I found that thoroughly impressive throughout the movie. And, you know, I initially thought the framing of the movie was kind of boring, but as time passed, I started to realize, oh, you're an idiot, this movie's almost 100 years old, you know, like there were limitations with what they could do. And so looking at it through that lens, I found it kind of a really well composed movie, and just that the camera angles are pretty standard. But what you had to do at the time to get those shots was really impressive, you know? And I will say the one consistent thing that, that comes through in the cinematography is just really nicely composed, centered shots, like, you know, from on top of a train car pointing forward, and you've just got the railway ahead of you, past Buster Keaton in the front car, and just a consistently a well-composed movie, and really, really good job of center framing, you know? And that stuff alone I found really impressive, you know? Not to mention some of the bigger stunts that we haven't talked about, like when Buster Keaton's on the train going, he's either going right to left or left to right, and the army is behind him going the opposite way. Yeah. That's an amazing shot. Like, there's so much scale to that shot, and it was just really impressive to see, you know? And I don't know, it just, like, again, almost 100 years later, I just thought, wow, this is amazing. You know, this is so impressive. Like, that shot would be cool now, in something where you can tell that it's all being done for real. But one thing that I found interesting in the first half hour of this movie is I was trying to figure out the tricks that they were doing to make these things work. And I'm just like, no, you fucking idiot. There were no tricks. You know, this is just a person being a lunatic, you know? And willing to do this for our entertainment, you know?
Yeah. The trick is to go to Oregon with hundreds of thousands of dollars, build a train track next to an old period appropriate train track, and hire hundreds of extras to march behind you and just shoot these expansive, spectacular shots. Yeah. And I just don't think that they ever really give in to the grandiosity. Like, it's definitely huge and epic, but it's still just so very focused on the story and on the gags and on the laughs and on Johnny, and it's not just showing off these huge vistas because they can and because they have it and because they're right there. It's still, you know, as you said, it's very propulsive and it's very just focused on the story, even when there's so much right there. Like, it's, you know, those hundreds of soldiers, you know, just in his background, that's just played for the laugh of someone being distracted by what they're doing and missing so much that's right near them. And I think it's just so impressive that they keep all that in service of the story when they could do, you know, just play it off as, look how much money we spent on this. You know, there's shots there that could be more spectacular, but they keep it on Johnny as a way to, you know, show all of this stuff in relation to him. It's not, look how big this movie is. It's, look how silly our main character is by missing all of these things happening behind him.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
And in that sense, I think geography is important. Again, you know, it's he's facing the camera and we have all these things going on behind him, and just the use of space. And I just think it's a gorgeous movie because there is just a ton of natural beauty that's shown, but it's as I said, I just don't think it's exploited as, you know, look how huge this project must have been. It's always in service of the narrative and the laughter.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So thank you for listening to the MacGuffin Man. If this podcast is poorly received when it is released, hopefully it will be reconsidered many years down the road by, I don't know, whatever the podcast equivalent of the AFI is. So thanks for listening.